Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to the CollectingCars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
We're here with Max Gerardo in his amazing premises in Fulham, and we're sitting right behind an original, not a fake, an original fully lightweight E-Type, which is in my top 10 cars I want to drive. It's just a gorgeous, stunning machine. I've driven a semi-lightweight, but not
one of how many cars, Max?
That's a really good question. I should know that off the top of my head, especially given that, shall we say, about 15?
Okay.
I should probably know that off the top of my head, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I'd say, well, no, you shouldn't, but let's say around about 15, of which 30 are competing regularly. and a bright, budgy yellow Daytona Spider.
With a great door handle.
Which has got a great door handle design, and it's one of the great cars to look at, not drive.
Which we've decided there's one road in the world that a Daytona works on properly.
What's that? Where is it? It's on the way down to Milan.
Between Milan. Actually, if I want to be really... And between Aosta and Milan, it's actually Santia and Milan. It's about 10 or 15K, and it's dead straight. Dead straight. Now that's the road for Daytona.
So we've decided the best road for Daytona is a straight autostrada.
Let me
Autopista, sorry. Yeah.
Let me find the coordinates. On the A4.
On the A4.
The A4.
So the way we want to do these podcasts, okay, is we want to speak to friends, pals who've got a view of the car market, be it the expensive cars or the cheap cars. Of living with them, the discussions we have around them, all the conversations you feel you can't have with your other mates, you know, the ones that in a pub, if you started talking about, you know, matching numbers, they'd say, oh, for crying out loud, Chris, Edward, you're boring. I want to talk about, first of all, what we've done in the last week, because it's a great way to start a podcast and to remind people what we do for a living. So, Max, what have you done in the last week?
What did I do in the last week? So, last week I was supposed to go ice driving with Tuthill. And and due to global warming, on Sunday I got a text message saying ice driving cancelled because the ice is too thin.
It's been a problem this year for him.
It's been a problem for him this year. So and I was going with some friends, and the idea was we're all going to go to Munich, meet in Munich, and go all together ice driving. So so my friend said, you know what, you've got a ticket to Munich anyway. Let's go for dinner in Munich anyway, and then come back on Tuesday. That's quite rock and roll. So off I went on Monday, went to Munich anyway, had dinner at like 1 o'clock in the morning. Somebody around the table, eight of us all going ice driving, said, we've booked this restaurant for Wednesday night after ice driving in Sweden. It's supposed to be this, like, we booked it a year ago. It's supposed to be this amazing culinary experience, 30 courses, you cannot get a table, it's impossible. And someone at dinner said, you guys have come to Munich for dinner. Let's go to Sweden for dinner on Wednesday. Do we have to? And of course, what happens? Everyone puts their hands up at dinner. And I'm like, oh, I just want to go home. Like, of course, I've got to go to Sweden for dinner on Wednesday. So I stayed in Munich. I had to go shopping for underpants, socks, and trousers. Stayed in Munich until Wednesday. Flew to Sweden. Had dinner. Amazing dinner. The most amazing dinner ever. Flew back to London on Thursday. Went to collect my car from Short Stay Car Park at Heathrow Airport because I thought I was going for one night. Paid £225. Had a bit of indigestion after dinner and I came to the office.
So Max is confirming that the life of the international classic car broker is just like working at McDonald's, isn't it? So he's flown for two dinners, come back and still groused about a £200 parking bill. I'd have thought that was the same as the starter in Sweden. But something about cars, come on, you must have, no, have you interacted on, with a motor vehicle in the last week.
Sorry. Of course. So when I was in Munich, I went to look at a whole bunch of cars. I went to look at a collection of Alphas whilst I was there. Might as well make good use of my time. I went to see a guy that's got like a 33 Daytona, which we had one which we just sold. He's got a Maserati 300S. He went to show me his new Alpha 155 DTM in martini livery.
Right, okay, let's stop there. So because these are beginning to become valuable, aren't they? Is that because they've worked out how to run them now without the engines blowing up, or what's going on?
Yeah, I think that they're easier. They're easier to run now. There's people that, someone's figured it out, and now they're becoming of that age where they're cooler and cooler. And there's a series. So he was saying to me that in Germany there is a series for old DTM cars. So he's got 155 DTM, and he thinks it's a competitive, fast car. And so he's gone out.
What do you think they're worth?
I think they're worth, a 155 DTM's worth somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 euros.
But is this the very end when they were just one big diffuser and wing?
It's
and
unbelievable. I mean,
does that need a team to run it, or can you roll that off the transporter?
No, you can't start. You can't roll our transporter. I mean, first of all, you can't roll our transporter because it's about an inch off the ground. So you probably need like a low loader to, you know.
This is the era of what we loosely termed super touring cars. So the British touring car series, the BTCC, wasn't quite in line technically with Germany. Germany was more advanced in some respects, but even in the UK, a Mondeo from the late 90s cannot be started until you warm the block, because the piston is seized against the side of the cylinder. I mean, the engines are just little racing machines. They're unbelievably complicated and expensive to run, and they've always been almost valueless in the classic car market because you can't use them. They're just static objects.
So how does a gentleman racer take a DTM to the circuit today?
He has his guys take it, and there is probably three or four guys to... It's probably to run it. I mean, it's we all look, how do you do it? If you know what you're doing, I'm sure that, two people, you start it, you go to your laps, and it's probably easy. Maybe you don't eke out every last tenth like they did when it was...
I think a lot of it's down to revs, isn't it? If the thing revved to 11 in period, you rev it to 10, and the engine life that you get from that is exponential, because every last RPM is just killing engine life. I still think that era of motorsport where they had super high revving, normally aspirated engines, is the most exciting, particularly in saloon car shapes. They sound amazing, but how it's economical, I don't know. Yeah. Having said that, I drove a Nick Swift Mini, one of these things. What I've done in the last, but that's actually 10 days ago.
Was that matching numbers?
Matching numbers. But I drove one of these Nick Swift Minis. I've seen them at race circuits for years, watched them irritate me with their speed.
Yeah.
What a thing that is.
But I drove it as well. I drove one at Goodwood, and I found it terrifying.
The most
terrifying car to drive ever.
Because you don't use the steering wheel. You get the thing vaguely in a straight line. If you back off, the camber of the road means it just turns whichever way it fancies.
It's terrifying. I was honestly terrified around Goodwood, and you just
I'm about to race one at Goodwood. You're not helping here.
You will be fine because you're talented.
My other car stuff this week, I have a classic Range Rover. It's one of the things that's closest to my heart. I've got a soft dash, which is that one year they made them in 94. Mm-hmm. So they announced the P38.
God, you're such a train spotter.
I am. They announced the P38, which is the 90s, the Essex Boys Range Rover, the one they painted yellow. The one in layer cake is the best way to describe it. They announced that, and everyone went, oh, it's not a real Range Rover. So to appease those people, they made one more year of classic Range Rovers.
Right.
As much as anything to hedge their bet, that if the P38 failed,
they could
just carry on Defender style, making the old one. But they put a different dashboard in it with a load of Rover 800 switchgear. Rover 800. I mean, if you were gonna nick parts from a car, you wouldn't. That's like you could make any human being. You'd nick the personality from Edward Lovett. You wouldn't do that,
right? Thank you.
So basically, they did this car with the Rover 800 dashboard, and I love them. I've had a few,
You've had a few.
I've had a few of them, yeah. And I bought this one many years ago, And I made the mistake of thinking, you know, when you move cars around between, like, you've got a lockup like I have that's not very conveniently placed, and you can have a couple of cars on your property, but not many. And sometimes you think, I can leave that one outside just for a bit. Mm. I'll leave it outside. Well, of course, then I get busy. So I left it outside 4 weeks ago, went to start it. She's a bit flat. Then you think, oh, I don't remember that being damp. Then you look under the carpet and squish it and go, where's that come from? And then you realise that a Range Rover's windscreen seal, it's kind of semi-porous. The water's coming in through the windscreen.
They all do that, sir. It's a special feature.
I love my classic Range Rover. Yeah. There's nothing else that I want instead of it. There's something about burbling around in it, the driving position, the noise it makes. I think that that's very, very overinflated super SUV market has been trying to capture the essence of the classic Range Rover for 20 years, and I still don't think they've quite managed it. I think the new G-Wagon comes closest.
You both are fans of the charm,
because these cars are about charm. You can't justify them any other way. They're not as good as a saloon car, and if you want to go properly off-road, you buy a Defender. They mix both. Mm. But there's something about the way they look, the way they make you feel, the way you sit in them, that's just charming. The G-Wagon comes closest. But honestly, if you were to singerize a classic Range Rover, it would be a runaway success.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, what would it do better then?
It just is charming. It's just the shape is so iconic.
Well, there's a. Have you heard of Icon 4x4?
Oh yes, yeah. There we go. Icon
so 4x4. He's in the valley about 10 or 15 minutes from the guys at Singer, and he does it with FJ Toyotas.
Yep, that's right.
Ford Broncos. He's built a brand new chassis. He puts brand new Mustang V8 engines in these things, right. And they are incredible.
Mm. Yeah. I've heard about this. But how much are they? $300,000?
They're $250,000 plus.
Well, none of these things.
But the product's very special.
You were talking about the market for, you know, you're going to go to Rimac and buy a chassis, and then you'll go to different people to have them bodied. I think there's going to be a great future, or there is a great future for people like Singer and people, I don't know about Icon or Automobili Amos, all these sort of resto mod type cars.
Yeah.
It seems like they are all the rage. There are so many people. Not everyone does it well, and very, very few people do it well. I think there is
a subject of price of these things, but when you look at something that's executed so well, there is a huge difference between someone having a go in a shed and these guys that are properly engineering, you know, reimagining.
I hate to say it, they're not going to need to in the future. Because if you're into the styling, then you just have the base platform,
that's
chassis,
point,
whatever you call it. And it was honestly like having a Tamiya remote control car in the 80s. I can remember you'd turn up and my buddy had the Opel Manta and I had the Audi Quattro.
And we were... take the pins out.
We were partisan. Exactly. We were partisan about the fact that he had the Manta and I had the Quattro.
Yeah.
But actually, we had the same thing. Underneath, it was exactly the same machine with a different body on. And I can see that happening now. I mean, and don't forget, it's happened in the past. We've had badge engineered cars, haven't we?
Yeah.
So if you buy a Supra or a Z4... next year, if they ever sell you a Supra, how long has that been launched for? 19 years. That and a Z4 is the same car underneath.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a different body. So we've been there before, but it's just going to get... that's going to be amplified in the future. It really is. It's partly terrifying, because once they become too homogenized, do they have brand identities? I mean, it does put immense pressure on styling houses. I mean, we've seen...
Well, I wonder if... So you think that sort of the, you know, Pininfarina went bankrupt and then got rebought, and Touring went bankrupt and got sort of rebought. Well, these styling people, styling companies, houses, are they going to have a future now? Is that the place to be?
I think they do. Because let's look at the architecture of a modern motor vehicle. Is the architecture of a modern motor vehicle owned by or developed by the car company itself or by third-party engineering firms? Normally the latter, isn't it? Bosch. Let's say Bosch are the best in the world. Bosch probably owned the IP to most of the technology in your car. You know, if you want the best suite of electronic aids, then you buy Bosch. That's the best out there. So if Bosch said, well, we've got the architecture to the electric car,
and then
why would we sell it to Audi? We just make it ourselves, and then you can stick a Pininfarina body on it.
Yep.
But that's
one thing about the classic cars, that today you get into a, whatever it is, you know, a 911 or a Ferrari, and I know they're different, but I'd love to challenge someone, or whether it's a Audi and a Mercedes, to blindfold
you. Yeah, Pepsi challenge.
Sit in the car, drive it, and can you tell a difference? Whereas I tell you, the best thing is you look in the when the 356 or even a 911, you know, in 1965 you could buy a short wheelbase of Ferrari, which is a front engine V12, completely different thing, or a 911, which is a rear engine flat six. But the way you drive them and the way they drive are completely different.
Yeah.
Now a 911 and a F8 Tributo, whatever the new thing, the latest and greatest. I bet you, you know, I mean, people are going to like say my name in vain now for this, but I bet you they're actually quite similar, really, or not that different.
I think
not as different as they were.
My answer would be that I think they're fundamentally just as different as they were, but maybe the
performance,
but the electronics and the engineering that's gone into them has made them similar to drive. As long as you're using the systems, if you turn everything off in a GT2 RS, mm-hmm. it is mental. Absolutely yeah. mental. And what's okay. keeping it, what's homogenizing it, is the systems. You still have the ability to turn the systems off. But if you
maybe that's the problem. They're all the performance.
If
of
you
the
turn
new
the systems
so
off,
so good.
Yeah.
That you have to run them on the systems.
Let's mm-hmm. take this. So we're gonna one subject for this podcast with Max, which I think fascinates myself, Max, and Edward, is the obsession with this phrase matching numbers. And when I say it, I grin and I grimace and I. In some respects, it's the phrase that encapsulates everything that I don't like about the collecting car world, because it's such a tricky phrase.
It's actually funny. I was just thinking about it now. You know, in Italy, there is no word for matching numbers. So if you talk to somebody, well, the interesting thing is, like, you'll hear in conversation Italian collectors, and they'll say, "Sì, ta, va bene, alla macchina, my matching numbers." So they actually, and in France,
that's brilliant.
And in France, same thing. You know, oui, bonjour, la voiture, elle est matching. So they like actually. I just
they have to use the English
you've got
vocabulary.
To use the English. I wonder if it comes from America or something. But if it, you know, it was obviously a new word, right? And it's a new thing, which has come about in the last.
When do we think it became such an important aspect of the value of a car?
Well, I can tell you. So I was looking through an old Coys catalogue because we had a 275 GTS that we were trying to buy for a client. I looked at the old Coys catalogue, and in it from 15 years ago, maybe 18 years ago, and there was no mention of matching numbers, original engine. So that's an auction catalogue. Meaning that probably 15 or 18 years ago, yeah, probably maybe people would ask, but it wasn't quite as important. I would say that it started to rise in the last 10 years.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. In the last 10 years, it's become more and more important. As the values grow, then, and there's more information in the internet, and everyone sort of wants information about the cars, and more information is available. The Ferrari factory with a certification to confirm to you whether it's matching numbers, and Porsche with a certificate of authenticity. As this information comes out, then people start to look and pay attention.
But you are, even the auction catalogues have changed the way they've written about it in the last 6 years, because they went from matching numbers to not stating it at all, and now almost back to matching numbers.
So let's deconstruct this.
And then what is matching numbers?
That's the fourth question. Let's get to the first one is this, and I'm asking Max because this is your world, and also yours, Edward. I'm a lowly journalist, but I think, who does this benefit? That's the first thing you have to ask. When a new nomenclature is established, when a new classification comes about for something, be it cars or table tennis or whatever you want to talk about, it has to benefit someone. Someone's done it to benefit themselves. So what, who, and why?
It benefits the sellers. It is a seller somewhere that have said, "Hey, Chris, you should buy my Daytona Spider," you know, and you say, "Well, yeah, it's okay." And the seller said to you, "And you know, it is matching numbers."
And are they doing that because pitch. They think it adds value over and above other cars that they know don't have matching numbers?
Yeah, or that you can't confirm that's matching numbers, or the information's not there. Whereas some owner at some point said, "I've got it here in writing, this car from the factory, from wherever source, it's matching numbers, so therefore mine's better, and you pay more money."
I can already sense this is going to be a very slippery slope of a conversation.
The moment we've established why it's come to be, we already have the first problem, which is authenticity. So who authenticates? Who's the point of arbitration for what is matching numbers?
So I'll say to you that at the moment, the rightly or wrongly, but most people look to the factory.
Okay.
Number one. Rightly or wrongly, because...
No, but that's not...
The factories, the manufacturers.
Yeah, okay.
You go to BMW.
Well, it's funny, you know, we're sat here looking at a Ferrari, and I think one thing that's been very good for the last 8 or 10 years with Ferrari is that actually it's very difficult to fake a Ferrari. You can restamp a motor, but it's very evident that an original stamping is an original stamping. There's
Why
on
is
the
this
engine.
Daytona like XJS down there?
There's a, you know, you have a numero interno, so it's very. There's yep. a lot of experts out there. It's very. You can tell very quickly that a Ferrari, that's the original number. It's original engine.
But if you can fake a Rembrandt.
But if you know, if you're, the reason I'm saying
I disagree with him. You can. There is an old boy. You can make the fake cars. There's an old boy in
Italy.
Do you remember?
No, no. I'm not saying they're not making a fake car. I'm talking about the numbers. Where if you sent a Porsche 1973 2.7 RS Porsche engine number to someone at the factory, all they'll tell you is, yeah, that's the right number. They don't look at the actual condition of the real stamping.
Some train spotter to tell you if like the stamping is correct.
Okay, so anyway. we've agreed to not agree about who authenticates these things and whether they're doing it well or not. Then we have to ask, for me, why does it matter? Because a car in its current form is still a chassis with an engine dropped into it. It makes no difference to me, and I'm setting my colours out here, it makes no difference to me at all whether the engine was the original engine or not. I just want to make sure it has a really good engine.
Yeah.
That's what matters to me. So but that, the market doesn't care about that now.
The market doesn't care. And so let me start by saying that I think, I'll give you the reasons why, but then let me start by saying to you that I do think that matching numbers is way overhyped or people put too much importance to it. So there's two things first, right? Racing cars and road cars, right? On a road car, you would like it, or the buyer would like it, to be matching numbers, because you would think that that means the engine hasn't blown up, it's probably had an easier life, it's as it came out of the factory. And today, that's got a lot of value, right? People like that, you know? This car, and then if it has special history, let's say Steve McQueen drove this car, it's like, oh cool, this is the car, and that's the engine, and it's exactly as it came out of the factory, so some people put more value to that, all right? On a race car, it really shouldn't matter. However, let's say you buy the Aston DBR, the GT1, there's a DBR9 or that one Le Mans, in first of all Le Mans. Would you think it'd be cool? And this is impossible. Let's say there was two Le Mans winners that year. One has got the engine with which the car ran and won Le Mans, and the other one has an engine that was put in 5 years later. Which one has more value to you? Which one do you think is better?
Depends what I want to do with the car. If I want to go and if I want to sit and look at it and tell my mates that I've got the car, I want the engine that won Le Mans. If I want to use the car, then I want the freshest engine possible. But I also think this is where we get down to, you know, for English listeners, Trigger's broom scenario. It's fanciful to think that the engine that was used to win Le Mans was the one that was in it. Who knows?
But you're using that the car you're citing there. There are two examples, though, two DBR9s.
Yeah.
But we're sat here looking at a 962.
956.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry. A 956. Third at Le Mans, 1983. If you're going to sell that car, the first question, or I don't even know if you'll be asked the question, does it have its original engine in it? Because it has no bearing.
I hope not.
Yeah.
if it does, sometimes you think if that car's original engine, then there's something wrong. Someone's tampered with it.
Yeah.
I almost feel better if it doesn't.
I've been involved. I mean, to give you an idea of the resources available to all factory race teams for a long, long time.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
there, things get changed on racing cars that even the drivers don't know about, mm-hmm. and you're just told to get on with your job. And I've done it, even a Blancpain race, which is a pretty low form of motorsport. It's GT3. There's a lot of money flying around. I've been in a race where I was told after the race, when we'd done quite well, that the night while I was asleep the night before, a plane had flown in with an engine because a problem had been spotted. The manufacturer didn't want anyone to know about it. The engine had been changed during the night by the mechanics who'd worked through the night. And I understand why they looked so tired the next morning. And I raced with a brand new engine. That will never go down in the history of the car. That won't be logged anywhere. I'm not saying that car will ever be worth anything. But if it had been a significant racing car, does that mean the car's worth less money? Because no one knows about the engine change at all. It was done for practical reasons. Because ultimately, racing cars, when they race, when they're new, are there to do one thing, to win a race.
Yeah. And what we said, it's sort of crazy that an engine's a big thing. It's I don't know how many parts. There's a lot of moving bits. There's pistons and there's heads and there's... And when people talk about matching numbers, they're only talking about one bit of the engine. Just the block. And you could change everything else. Every piston, every camshaft, every tube, every radiator, nothing else from 1972 or whatever year the car is. As long as that just one piece of metal, because that's the only bit that's got a number stamped on it.
So
it makes no sense.
So we're slightly cynical, but if I bought a 2.8 RSR, which would be one of my ultimate cars. Mm. If I had a matching numbers 2.8 RSR.
Oh, matching numbers.
Well,
if it was not matching numbers, would it not be your ultimate car?
But if I've bought it and it happens to be matching numbers, but I've not paid overs because it is matching numbers. It was just offered to me as being a car with matching numbers. It's got the correct engine.
One owner from you, found
would,
in a bar.
Yeah. Would I go to Tuts, go to Tuthill and say, do me a motor, I'm bunging in there, a spec motor, so we put this one on the shelf because that retains the value of my car? I probably would. Because I'm at the behest of the marketplace.
I think you'd have
I?
To, because so you can go and drive it with confidence without even worrying. Because you know these cars are expensive, and you have got to protect the value in some way. I would have thought.
Well, I mean, the $10 million question is: what is the price difference of two identical cars? One's matching numbers, and one's not.
God, it's all just the same old chestnut. It's whoever's in the room, isn't it?
Yeah, but also that's you're, if, what if do you're you saying think? Make a new engine.
Well, you price these things. So this Daytona Spider here, okay, without power steering, it's one of the purest, worst driving experiences you can ever have. It's a beautiful, beautiful
but
car.
With a top down.
It is just a stunning motor vehicle. It's gorgeous. You know, you can pretend you're Tubbs and Crockett. It's just mega. So if this had the wrong donkey in it,
yeah,
how much less?
So well, I think that's a very interesting question. Not because that story... Or that number has changed a lot as the value of the car.
As value goes up, that number's gotten bigger.
Correct. So it's probably today, it could be 30%,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'll go as far, it's almost, yes, it's 30%. And on top of that, for a road car, which Ferrari is the worst example, for a road car, Ferrari, that's not matching numbers, 30% cheaper, and you still have to find the person that's going
to
buy it. You know
you
why?
Would struggle to sell
because,
it.
Because that car is worth, you know, whatever, $2.5 million. And you can take 30% off, and it's, you know, 1.75 million. But someone that's got 1.75 million, not always.
Would rather spend more to have the real one.
But the interesting thing, so Ferrari will, for you, make a brand new Classic A block for it. So
still not matching numbers.
It hasn't got its original engine in, but they'll put an original spec engine in.
A letter from the factory makes it a much easier pill to swallow for the next owner, isn't it? Yeah. A piece of paper with Ferrari saying, we made an engine for this.
And it's interesting how so many of the manufacturers are now investing and getting more and more involved in this, in their old cars and restoring certain, you know, BMW, Ferrari, obviously Mercedes have been doing it for a long time.
Collecting Cars, the safe, smart and simple way to buy and sell collectible cars. An online auction platform for the UK and Europe. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
The collectingcars.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Welcome back to the Collecting Cars podcast with Max Girardo. That's at Girardo & Co. on Instagram, and Edward Lovett at Edward Lovett on Instagram. And I don't know what's mine. I think I'm at Harris Monkey, aren't I? Which people don't like. The etymology there, by the way, is based on Only Fools and Horses rather than anything simian. And there's something outside that I want to talk about now, because I know it's not an organised second subject, but you've just got an E46 M3 CSL outside.
Yeah.
Okay. That, for me, that's one of the great BMWs of the modern era.
I agree.
Prices have just dipped nicely. And I think in a way that sort of buoys me up again, because I've been looking at these things for 80 grand and thought, it's overcooked. Mm-hmm. At 80 grand, they're not going to be used. They're going to be sat inside, people talking about the fact they own them. They're owned by the wrong people. But it feels like we're getting back into a more sensible area of the marketplace. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And which is great. So people jump in, people use them.
Maybe why did you want one of those?
So I can tell you, I drove one. Why did I want one of those? I drove one. I went to Southend to look at a car, and I went to the storage facility where Abba Kogan had all of his cars, and Abba had his car out there. This is like 10 or 15 years ago, and I had to go somewhere else an hour on. And he said, take my CSL. And that's it's your car. I said, no, take it, and 8,000 RPM. Do it. Like, take it. And so I took it. I drove for 50 miles to see somebody else, drove back, and it was such a memorable drive. Such a memorable drive. I always said to myself, one day I will own one again.
I love that in that era of M3, and I think they've probably still got it in the brand new M cars as well, where when you turn it on, the lights are on up until 3,500 or 4,000 RPM, and as it warms up, you can start stretching the legs.
Such an epic drive.
Unless you're a journalist and you ignore the lights completely and use 8,000 RPM immediately.
Such lazy stereotypes. I still look back on the E46 M3 as being one of the BMW sweet spots. It was the last of their proper analog cars. Yeah. It was a simple design with simple driving characteristics.
The dashboard is so simple.
E39 M5, E46 M3.
That after that, they got a bit confused, either with a bit of bangle styling or they went a bit too clever with V10 engines and SMG gearboxes. They became expensive cars to maintain and warrant. That's still relatively a simple car.
And you know what? It's quite. I mean, you know, you're telling me about the gearbox is so slow. And it is, by modern standards, it's not like...
But you work with it.
But you work with it. And I tell you what, as I can tell you from my Sunday drive, when you're at 8,000 RPM and you change gear, okay, maybe it's a second or half a second slower, but to be honest with you, I don't care, because when I change gear, it went bang!
Bang.
And I was excited because it's single clutch in it, and I felt the whole car shudder. I was like, this is great. I don't want
the induction noise on that
fantastic
car.
It doesn't matter if it's a bit slower.
And I'll show my age now. That 2002, I think it was, or 2003, BMW invited a few of us as journalists to the Nürburgring, to the new circuit, to the Grand Prix circuit, to drive this vehicle they had called the M3 CSL Concept. And we got there, and there were 10 of those things. They were with concept written on them, and they were saying, we're not necessarily building this. And we were a few of us walking around going, that looks pretty finished to me, guys. And the weather was just biblical. And it was the first car ever to use
cut slicks.
Pilot Sport Cup, which in those days was a pretty basic piece of rubber. It was a racing compound with some grooves cut in it that wouldn't move any water at all. And they had a little area inside the car park at the back of the circuit where you could do some skids under the supervision of a BMW driver. And most of the journalists were just spitting off everywhere and decided to go and drink coffee.
Not Harris, of course.
No. They were. Let me finish it. This is not an ungreat story at all. It was I'm reckless and I was quite young story. So we then go, I'm there with Richard Meaden. So Dickie Meaden's there for Evo, and I'm working for Autocar magazine. And the circuit just gets wetter and wetter and wetter. And we're supposed to be objectively testing this car. And you know, the car manufacturers don't really like it when you just go and slide cars everywhere, because all their hard work goes into making a great chassis and you just go and do massive skids. They say, can you not do that? Anyhow, it just degenerated into a skid fest between myself and Meaden. The weather was so bad, it was soaking wet everywhere, and we just did about 20 laps fully lit sideways in these things. I learned nothing about the car. I remember coming back and writing this story thinking, just feels like an M3 to me. It makes a bit more noise. But you couldn't tell anything about the grip. They told us about these hubs. Because the hubs, go look at the hub arrangement and all the wheel carriers are all hugely uprated on your car just to deal with lateral load, because the tyre gave more grip. We couldn't tell you anything about the tyre. All I could tell you was the tyre was a bit more shit in the wet. It was useless. Anyhow, the best about the story was BMW used to have a policy that if you went with them on a trip, they looked after you. So if you went back to your room and had a whiskey or something, they paid for it, and that was that. Which was probably in those days taking a free gift without realising it. Anyhow, we come down as the English group the next morning in the Dorint Hotel at the Nürburgring.
Oh yes.
And the girl who was looking after us stops us at the door and says, "You need to pay your extras." And I'm thinking, extras? Well, I didn't have any extras, so I go and stand in the queue. I think actually I had a bottle of fizzy water. and there's a queue in front of me of British journalists who remain nameless. And the person in front of me, of the establishment, the woman says, yes, you have to pay your extras to get, and he was looking a bit sheepish, so I don't think I had any extras. You watched a film, yes? And he goes, by mistake, I pressed the film. And she said, I tell you, I kid you not, this film, Shaving Ryan's Privates. Had to pay, I think it was like €12, and then walk off with his head down, and I'll never mention his name. But that was the year that BMW stopped paying for the extras on
because of the CSL.
And we were given a key ring. We were given a key ring, and I still have it. It's a lovely thing, and it contains all of the materials. They fan out of all the materials, special materials used in the car. It's a very, very special car, and. In some respects, it deserves to be $100,000, but I'm really glad they're dropping down a bit and people are going to use them. The fact that I saw one out here, I thought, oh, great, people are using them again.
Yeah, I drove.
No, well, I said to you the other day, I think, you know, it's got to a sensible level now where someone can sort of save the price and you go like, fine, let's do it. You don't need to go and do much research. It sort of feels fair.
It's the same. I don't know how much is a fancy Golf these days. Like
a brand new Golf.
Like not a fancy one. Like
you can do $40,000 on a Golf R. Yeah. I mean, I think if you bought one new, I'm surprised at how I'm learning at the moment with some of the cars I've been driving, just how list prices are mean nothing now because they're all pre-registered. So once you go and buy one from the garage that's done 20 miles, I mean, that's the other thing I've been doing to bore you in the last week is I've been getting ordinary cars in. I'm always accused of being out of touch. So I thought...
I'm slightly disappointed you haven't turned up in the Corsa. Vauxhall Corsa.
Well, I was in the Corsa yesterday and I thought it might be a stretch too far to come up here in it. But so what I did was my assistant Christian, who's a great lad, works really hard for me. I just said, look, can you book in the top 10 best-selling cars in the UK? Research what they are. Let's book them in. Let's do some Instagram stories about them and try and understand...
why they're so good.
And also just understand what the current car market is about. Because I get drawn into the fast stuff and the expensive stuff, and I've just lost touch with reality. That's what happens, isn't it, as you get older. If you're lucky enough to graduate beyond that point, you forget what it was like. Mm. So the first one we had in was a Mercedes C220 diesel. That's in the top 10. Remarkable machine. Averages 55-60 to the gallon, almost uses no fuel at all, 0-60 in well under 7 seconds, 148 miles an hour flat out. It is all things to all people, but it's £45,000 for a basic C-class Mercedes. It's with, you know, cloth seats.
I'd rather have a CSL.
Yeah, of course you would. But actually, you know, if you're in the market for that car, it's not £45,000, is it? You go in and
it's by the time £99 a month.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all on the monthly, as I'm now realising. We almost have reached the stage where we shouldn't have list prices for cars anymore.
It's monthly rental prices.
And I'm now in a Corsa. I drove a Corsa yesterday, a 1.4 litre turbo Corsa with 100 horsepower. Utter dirt box. Just, I mean, how they sell them, I don't know. It must all be to lease rental houses or what have you.
But it must go somewhere at some point.
I think you drive on the motorway sometimes, you see about 10,000 of them parked port somewhere. So
I posted the spec sheet, the picture of the spec sheet on Twitter, saying, how is this thing £20,000? And that within 10 minutes, someone had come back with a picture of one that had done 20 miles, 68 plate, for £11,900 at a dealer up north. So, you know, the prices mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But the cost of modern cars, for me, is the basis of the man maths that creates this community. Because what I do is, I sit there and I go, right, let's be sensible. I'm going to buy a new... whatever, and be sensible. Let's buy a new E63 because it's reliable, it's got a warranty, and that's going to cost me whatever. And then a couple of whiskies, a bit of a search on Pissinet, Girardeau & Co. Then I'm suddenly going, oh, what could I have instead? And that's how you sit down to buy a Mercedes S350 to get you around and be comfortable, and you end up the next day thinking, I just bought a Bentley Mulsanne.
That might be slightly particular to you. I don't know if everyone does. I mean, I hope more people do it.
But I think increasingly with the way that the market is moving and the way that I think there's a sense we all have that this is the witching hour now. We've got a few years left of really enjoying these cars. You might, in 5 years' time, are you going to be smoking around London in a CSL? I'm not sure you are.
Probably not.
So get out there and do it now.
I'm going to take a leaf out of Ed's book and have an i3. Actually, no, I'm going to have an i3S.
i3S. Well, you would have to do that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I've just got a second-hand i3 that I thought I bought well at $18,000 or something like that.
Do you know anyone that's got a BMW dealership?
Yeah, I didn't.
So, I'll ask this randomly, and I do this to my friends sometimes when I'm in the pub. You've got 15 grand to spend on a car. Let's forget about the toppy-toppy. We do toppy-toppy. £15,000. And this is, sadly, Collecting Cars, the amazing auction facility online, has not launched yet. So you've got to go and buy this thing somewhere else. By the summer, you'll be doing this on the auction site, because this is where we'll be all night. I'll be drinking my whiskey going, oh, I'll have one of those. I mean, the amount of tat I'm going to end up buying. But 15 grand, what'd you buy?
15 grand.
Is there any rules here?
No.
Can it be
no.
the Corsa from that dealer? That's 68.
Yeah, yeah,
no, you're no. buying a, you're buying something fun.
Fine, okay.
Ooh. I'd like something 80s, rear-wheel drive, with a little bit of umph to it. For 15 grand, I would buy...
Can you get that for that money?
I don't know.
Well, I think you probably go and buy an E46 M3.
I think you're right. Yeah. A non-CSL a manual, M3.
Small wheels, so the 18-inch wheels, yeah. not the big wheels.
Yeah.
That would be a good car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would still perform like it did in 2002 or 2001 when they came out. I was selling those cars new.
Oh, you're showing your age?
Or not.
Yeah. I can remember turning up to see you in a pre-prod, like a... It was a very early M3, and you were working at your Bristol dealership.
Would you still do that in Bristol around roundabouts in E46 Shh. M3?
Probably would. Yeah. No, so I think the E46 is a car that resonates. Maybe that's my new sort of point of arbitration. I say to people, do you like the E46 M3? And if they don't like it, I don't want to be their friend.
I've in the classic car world, I've decided that. I'm not sure. I've found people that own Lamborghinis that are also charming and nice. Maybe that's my like. Do you own a Lamborghini in your collection? And if you do, then I just have to adjust.
Yeah, mate. I've got a Gallardo. I've got one of those e-gear Gallardos.
I've got Gallardo. I think got car pronunciation. That's another one. That's another one for another day.
So it sounds like you need to buy. You need to sell some of your things.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you need to buy an E46 M3. Sounds like.
Do you know what? I'm looking at that CSL.
Didn't you have an E30?
And I think
I've got an E30 M3 rally car that I still. I had a black Sport Evo that I sold, but I think the E30 road car thing is a bit overbaked for me.
It's not very good on the road.
They're okay. They're just a bit gutless. You know, you can sit there and crap on about steering feel and chassis balance, but when you get smoked in a straight line by a bloke in a 320D, you are thinking. Want a bit more oomph, really. So that I think they're gorgeous things. I love what they stand for more than perhaps the way they.
I think
perform.
You know when it comes to classic cars, and I tell people this all the time. You know because people come in here in the showroom, have come in their brand new S class and their brand new Bent, whatever it is, which is an amazing driving machine. Range Rovers now they're just all so good, and I think that sometimes when you get into an old car, or often when you get into an old car, you have to sort of. Flick the switch in your head, and I think people forget to do that. So it's easier if you're getting out of your brand new whatever it is, you know, even a Golf, and you get into a 50s car because you feel different, and 60s as well, 70s. But you have to remember that these cars are 30, 40 years old. You know, you talk about the E30 M3. How old is that?
Well, it must be getting on 40 years old now, isn't it? No, 30 years. It was launched in 85.
95, 2005, 2015.
Yeah,
it's a 30-year-old car.
I know.
And although it looks modern,
yeah, yeah.
And when you get into it and you think, this should be like a modern car, but don't forget, it's 30 years, is a long time ago.
I think
you've just got to slow it all down and enjoy it.
But it's an interesting point that there is a point at which modern tyre technology and power outputs cross over a bit, and I think the E30 M3 is in an unfortunate place because the modern tyres you put on it are quite grippy. And it's only got 200 horsepower, so it doesn't really move around at all. It's not that quick, but it was so good in its day. It actually feels dynamically quite modern. So what it does now is it feels like a slow, modern car. Whereas if you get in a, you know, you drive that E-Type there, I mean, they're just stunning because they move around the whole time. In fact, one of the strangest sort of conclusions I've reached about modern performance cars that I've been testing for my day job recently is that when you turn all the systems off, they start to feel like really old cars. Like a Pista on a circuit, a Pista around Fiorano feels like an old D-Type.
If you turn everything off.
Because it's got so much more torque than the grip can deal with and the track can deal with. Every corner you're coming out like this, sideways. And I thought, I remember this. This was like driving at Goodwood last year in a modern Ferrari. So it's quite interesting. It becomes like an old driving experience. But obviously with that, there's a lot of pitfalls. If you get it wrong, you're off.
Mm.
But the E30 M3 is a good example of being slightly the wrong side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Lotus Sunbeam or something a little bit older with less grip,
then it's
that really does move around and feel old school.
Yeah.
Or weirdly, my E28 M5, that I won't sell that because that is that has tomorrow's engine with yesterday's tires.
Well, that's what I think people forget now. Like you the driving experience that you have. I'm bored of listening about performance and lap times around the Nürburgring and how much horsepower, because on the road is, you know, can't. I want to hear about driving experiences. And I also, the other thing is, I want to hear about what is it like inside when you're sitting in the car. Not to bang on about the CSL, but they're like a GT3 RS. When you get into these, you know you're in something sporty.
You don't have to drive it quickly to feel special.
No, you feel like, and I like the Alcantara steering wheel, and there's carbon here, which probably makes no difference.
I've stopped you there. Alcantara steering wheel, no.
You don't like them?
Okay.
Oh, that was the first car. Well, they were definitely, E46 was the first era where M3 steering wheels were getting quite chunky.
Give you two reasons
why.
They
wear out.
First of all, Alcantara was designed to provide grip against a glove. If you're not wearing a glove, it's not very grippy.
Oh, you don't wear driving gloves?
We all
wear driving gloves.
There you go.
Leather ones.
And the other one is, and I broadly under the heading of mung, M-U-N-G, there is DNA in there that I don't want. The steering wheel on my AMG is a year old, and it's got a matte colour. It's just been flattened down because lots of people drive my estate car for work, and I know that they go and have chips or a McDonald's, and there's just other people's matter in my steering wheel. And I don't
want
that.
That's not your car, though, is it?
Well, it's owned by Mercedes-Benz. I lease it from them.
But if it was your... So that is your car?
That is my... I lease that car, yeah.
I wouldn't let
the avoidance
of
doubt.
You could just sort of get a new set of friends.
To use the word friends, I'll give you a good anecdote, and he won't mind me sharing this for the record. Mr. Matt LeBlanc is a big AMG fan as well. It would be a ML63 AMG. He's done lots of miles and he's very fond of it. And he was the one that made me obsessed with mung, because there's something about these steering wheels that was annoying me. They
what
lose
mung,
grip.
Sorry.
Mung just means messed, sort of scuzz. It's a great word. Mung,
I don't have it on my steering wheel.
It's onomatopoeic, isn't it? You say mung and you do imagine it. And he got so fed up with the Alcantara shining up and just being horrible, he went to his Merc dealer and ordered, he got them to do him a leather steering wheel. So he's got a proper leather steering wheel. And it's nicer. Alcantara is just it's a marketing fad that you two have bought into. Good, and now you've been educated.
No, I just said I like an Alcantara steering wheel.
I feel like I didn't buy my M3 CSL. I don't know if I can drive anymore. I'm gonna have to.
We can just
so,
get. Would
so,
you want
to
buy it?
So LeBlanc's.
I need to out it now.
Don't tell me 49.995.
In 30 years' time, we're going to be offering LeBlanc's AMG on the auction platform.
Specially ordered with a leather...
Exactly, yeah.
One of one.
Leather rim.
Matching numbers.
Matching numbers. Leather rim.
Leather rim!
Well, I think that's a good place to conclude this first podcast. So thank you to Edward, and thank you to Max, and also the beautiful surroundings of this showroom, which he doesn't know this yet, is going to become a regular haunt for this particular production, because we get to sit amongst beautiful cars and gas absolute nice. Tommy Rot about cars, but great fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Don't forget, guys, follow us on Instagram at collectingcars.com, and we'll have all of our podcasts listed on your podcast provider.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.